This is Indigo Radio, deepening understanding and making connections.
Radio, and I'm here with my co-host Chris. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Anna. How are you today?
Pretty good. We're really excited to have Jonathan in the Zoom studio. Jonathan Elwell, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Great to be with y'all.
And Indigo Radio is a project of the Spark Teacher Education Institute based out of Southern Vermont. We're a group of educators seeking to learn through engaging with others in our community and throughout the world. You can find us at indigo.radio on Instagram or Facebook, and you can also download a previous show on SoundCloud and Apple iTunes. Indigo is now broadcasting out of Southern Vermont, Western Mass, Atlanta, Seattle, and Morocco. And what's awesome about this is that we now have like a cross Atlanta Vermont show happening today, which we haven't had yet. So I'm excited about that. So we are really happy to have you with us, Jonathan, to talk to us about prisons and especially surrounding the history of these institutions in Vermont. So welcome to the show. And can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, my name is Jonathan, use he, him pronouns. And I live in Brattleboro in Southern Vermont and involved with, you know, a variety of different organizing efforts around community safety, policing, prisons. And I'm excited to talk with y'all today.
We are as well. My name is Chris Levensey. I teach high school social studies in Springfield, Vermont. And one of my classes that I teach is called The History of Mass Incarceration. And Jonathan, I wonder if you could start us off, just tell us a little bit about the work that you're currently doing and how you got involved in this.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm doing a lot of organizing with FreeHER around the state's plan for a new women's prison. And that organizing has really popped up in the last like year or so, especially, and started to grow and do a lot of base building. Yeah, in response to these plans that the state of Vermont has to spend $90 million on a new prison. And we're urging the state, obviously, to not invest that money in a new prison, but to instead move towards decarceration and, you know, getting at the root causes that lead people to actually be incarcerated in the first place. Yeah, and so I think a lot of what we're going to talk about today stems from some curiosity that I and other FreeHER organizers had when, you know, we heard about these plans. We were curious to kind of dive into Vermont's history of incarceration, having learned about different analyses of incarceration in other states or in other contexts, wondering, you know, what that looked like in Vermont and realizing that that really wasn't there. So we had to kind of put it together ourselves.
The quote that I've heard you say before, and if you could speak to this a little bit, tell us what it means, but the road to a new prison is paved with good intentions. And could you talk about that and connect it to what's happening in Vermont?
That's a line that we use in some of our teach-ins to try to help contextualize, you know, what's proposed with how we got here. And so the current prison, you know, it's not being described as a prison. It's being described as a sort of correctional and reentry facility that will have all of these different resources and programs that we just cannot provide in the current prisons that Vermont DOC operates. And so this new facility, as they say, is really necessary to be able to kind of realize that sort of like reformist vision of something more rehabilitative, more humane, more supportive. And what we find when we look at Vermont history, both with, you know, the prison system that we have now, especially Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, which is Vermont's one women's prison, but also looking further back at other periods of Vermont history, lots of different institutions or programs that we now look back and see as like very inhumane, very violent, abusive, coercive at the time that they were being created, were seen as these positive, humane reforms. And so to hear that sort of language around what's proposed is not actually, you know, really new in any particular way. And so that's kind of what we try to do, you know, talking about how the road to a new prison is paved with good intentions.
Having heard you speak, that was something that was really powerful to me, to connect these dots historically and look back and our memories around this too. And I thought this continues to be a really powerful place and way to look at this, what's happening presently.
I was just going to add too that language is so important. And so I like that you point out these phrases that are used instead of prisons. So like, I know it's Chittenden Correctional Facility, or this like re-entry. And I also remember having a discussion around the usage of the term prison guard versus correctional officer. And that when you use a word like correctional, of course, it's tied to a very deep notion in our society that the individual needs to be corrected, there's something wrong with the individual. They did something wrong and their behavior needs to be corrected. And so I think it's really important that you bring that in and what are the words that we use?
I think also to add on to that, Anna, that the intentionality of that, those changes and knowing that this in some way might make it more palatable to people to, or pass these markers if we do change our language around it as if it's changing the essence of what's happening. And that's really important and interesting. So thank you.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to, you know, dig into this more as we talk, but then it really also raises the question, you know, if we are trying to like change the language, if we are coming positive intentions, how do we end up having these same outcomes time and again? Because then we often hear in like so many different spaces these days talking about like impact versus intention. And then it really raises the question of like, you know, what does the prison do? Like what's the function of incarceration across different like moments in history?
Mm-hmm.
Addressing that, I was just, really, really thought a lot about your presentation at The Root for a long time after that and how I can modify what I teach to incorporate more of that and be sharper in the analysis of what we're doing. And it's tough to scaffold that for kids, but I think that that's the job. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. And so, but I also thought that maybe this, you mentioned the purpose of prisons, and that might be a next place we go if you want to talk to that. What do you see as the purpose of prisons?
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of different answers to that question. Leaning on like the work of Ruth Wilson Gilmore, prisons are kind of a tool to resolve different crises and absorb surpluses. In her understanding, a crisis is basically when a system can no longer kind of continue functioning and reproducing itself in the same way that it has. A very concrete example is when a factory closes, then a certain portion of like the population in that place who have been working there and making money and reproducing their lives and, you know, in a certain way are now no longer able to do that. And so how will, you know, that creates a crisis, right? And there's this like surplus now that needs to be sort of resolved in some other way. And that could happen positively in terms of, you know, social spending to make sure that those people and their families have enough. That could be reinvestment in certain sectors to make sure people have jobs. That could be people moving or relocating to places where they can make a living. Or that could be also, you know, the state responding in more negative ways around policing or incarcerating people who are made surplus, which in Ruth Wilson Gilmore's analysis, looking at the California prison building boom across like the 80s and 90s, she charts this really clear and insightful history of, you know, surpluses of land, labor, capital as in the 1970s and 80s, farms were closing and consolidating, factories were moving overseas. And so there was this land that was previously in agricultural production in rural California that was now out of use. There were all these people who had worked on those farms, but also especially had worked, you know, in urban centers, in different industries, you know, where they had then lost their jobs. And also a lot of surplus capital that was looking to invest in new sectors to develop, that all kind of combined into what she calls the prison fix, which is, you know, this geographical response of like building prisons to absorb these surpluses in a moment where the state could have responded in so many different ways, but it responded building prisons. That's kind of one explanation that I think is pretty foundational about what prisons do, what their role is. But then there are also other explanations, like also thinking about Orisanmi Burton's recent book, Tip of the Spear, Prisons as War, which, you know, as he charts in like the late 60s, early 70s, especially, you know, was a very like mainstream understanding, both for folks who were radical organizers, either inside prisons or outside, and also for the folks who were in the government running the prisons themselves. They also saw this as kind of a front of imperial warfare and domestic war. And so I should also make it clear also that those two explanations are not necessarily competing explanations, right? They're very interconnected, flow together, and using those frameworks can help illuminate different things about Vermont history and about the current moment that we're in.
One of the follow-up questions I had going back to Gilmore and the information that you were giving us around these like empty land and then surplus capital is something else I've heard you say about workers in prison and how there's also this kind of story and narrative told to us that a prison will bring more jobs and will bring money into the area. And that's sort of seen as a good thing, that now people will have certain employment. And I just wanted you to speak to that and if that actually is a bit of a myth.
Yeah, that's a great question, because that often is used, you know, as one of like the key selling points to get a community to accept a new prison. You know, in the case of Vermont, the most recent prison that was built in the state was in Springfield. And, you know, at the time in 1999, when there was a forum in Springfield, just before a vote, a community-wide referendum on whether or not to move forward with the prison project, Howard Dean, the Democratic governor at the time, said, quote, "I'm doing this because this town needs help from the state. Let's not make a mistake about it. This is about economic development, and this is a good way for the state to help," which could not be clearer. But then also, there were a couple rounds of surveys of both incarcerated folks and also the staff at Southern State Correctional Facility, the prison in Springfield, that were done just a couple years ago. And those show that the folks who work there are experiencing negative mental and physical health outcomes almost to the same extent as the people who are incarcerated there. And so that data shows very clearly, you know, in Vermont too, this isn't an extrapolation from somewhere else, that, you know, working in a prison has the same effect of being in that abusive, violent, coercive environment.
A number of years ago, it's just reminding me, we interviewed this person that worked at Rikers. His job was to do wellness for prison guards. And so he talked a lot. He touched on what you're saying, was that those prison guards are also in prison every day. And it was astonishing to me, actually, the life expectancy of those people. It was really low. It was something like in their 50s. And also a lot of them, and I don't know if this is the case in Springfield, I can just imagine, maybe Chris, you can speak to this, is that a lot of the people in prison are coming from the same communities of the guards. And he talked about that too.
I don't have the, I would say, facts to about the population of Springfield's prisons, if they do come from here. I do know the narrative that was presented to the community in terms of the number of jobs that would be available to the community, revitalizing our community, things like they promise they would redo our, it's called the Edgar May swimming facility, that the town would have free access to that, and many other things that they had promised to us. And I think overwhelmingly, the town and the facts bear out that none of that came to fruition. Jobs were you know, from people out of state or no jobs available at all. The kind of social benefits that they promised have not been realized. I was talking with a fellow teacher of mine who was a student at the time, and they, at one point, we had 800 kids at the high school, and we're down to around 350, and our population has declined. And there's a number of things that this has failed to realize the promise of economic revitalization for this prison.
We want to talk to you about the history in Vermont. I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to say about how prisons fail on a number of different levels. Is there anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah, I guess I would just add a little bit of current context. So basically, everyone agrees that CRCF should close. You know, even folks who are staunchly in favor of a new prison, you know, agree that CRCF is an inhumane environment, you know, to hold people in. And, you know, that's actually used as a reason to kind of accelerate the process, you know, and like in a hearing a couple weeks ago with the House Corrections Committee, DOC Commissioner Nick Demmel was talking about how every year that we wait on this project is another year that people are in CRCF suffering, which, you know, is powerful language. But again, it's not new. Kent Stoneman, who was the commissioner of DOC in the early 1970s, when CRCF was actually proposed and then going to be built, said, quote, "The traditional closed institution has a consistent record of failure over the last 200 years, with increasing caseloads and steadily rising costs. Vermont cannot afford programs that are proven failures and will only become more wasteful of money and human potential." And adding to this context, also the Windsor State Prison, which we'll talk about, I think, more in a little bit, was at that point the oldest operating prison in the entire country and was like literally crumbling. And people saw it as inhumane. You know, it was not a place where they could have more rehabilitative programs, which were promised at a place like CRCF. So again, there was kind of the urgency to get to a place that could be more rehabilitative, which is exactly what we're seeing now. So yeah, just clarity that, you know, the idea that prisons are abusive environments is widely accepted. And so, you know, hopefully painting this history in like a fuller picture can help folks see that the acknowledgement of that is not a promise that something different will happen.
An icy wind burns and scars, rushes in like a fallen star through the narrow space between these bars, looking down on prison grove. Dug in, hunkered down, hours race without a sound, gonna carry me to where I'm bound, looking down on prison grove. Iron will, hard as rock, hold me up for the fateful knock, when they walk me down in a mortal lock, out on prison grove. Shine on all these broken lives. Shine on, shine a light on me.
So I would love to learn more about some of this history. Yeah, so if you could just start and just give us some of the history of incarceration in Vermont.
Yeah, so there's so much to say, but yeah, the kind of formal history of, you know, incarceration in prisons would start with the Windsor State Prison, which opened in, I believe, 1807. And at the time, it was the largest and most expensive building in the entire state, which I think says something about early state making on like the colonial frontier, you know, and the need to kind of impress, you know, order through violence. But also, it's important to be very clear that at that time, you know, it was also seen as kind of a more enlightened way to deal with, you know, folks who had been convicted of crimes, because previously the common way to do it was just corporal punishment, things like whipping, you know, or other like physical punishments like that. And so incarceration itself was like a positive reform that, you know, allowed for contemplation and reflection and the rehabilitation of the person who'd been convicted of a crime. But it's also important to be clear that it operated at like nowhere near the scale of prisons today, you know, in terms of how many people were incarcerated there. And that many of the folks who end up in prisons today, both in Vermont and nationwide, would at that time have actually ended up in a process called hiring out, where in the late 1700s, early 1800s, you know, these folks who were, you know, quote unquote surplus, essentially, you know, people who were too poor to support themselves, were loaned out into indentured servitude, you know, yearly at the town meeting. But then by like the 1820s, there were so many people who were dispossessed, you know, and unable to support themselves and their families, that the state needed a new solution. And so then towns turned to poor farms. And poor farms operated all the way from the 1820s up until the 1960s. And they share kind of many of the attributes of like modern prisons, you know, and different incarcerative institutions in terms of being located kind of on surplus land, like subpar agricultural land outside of towns. You know, folks who were there were literally called inmates much of the time. People who were often disabled or unable to support themselves, or also, you know, there were more kind of like transient folks in terms of like different economic crises as they would periodically hit. Then those people would go to the poor farms. As jobs and different opportunities became available again, they would move off of the poor farms. So they really provided this very clear example of absorbing those surpluses in a way that prisons do today.
Jonathan, was that a nationwide practice, would you say then? And in various places, did it have different manifestations of racial or ethnic component to it or focus?
Yeah, definitely. I know, you know, different states had all sorts of different similar solutions. I don't know a ton about what it looked like in different states. And there's honestly not a ton of research about what it looked like in Vermont. So I can't necessarily speak to like the racial component. Yeah, no, it's definitely, a pretty widespread practice to have poor farms or poor houses or other similar sorts of institutions.
And also the poor farms, these people, were they working the farm? Is that correct? Like they're doing labor on the farm?
Some people. Yeah, not everybody.
Okay, got it.
Folks who physically could work were often forced to work, yeah.
Yeah, okay. My understanding is that the poor farms in the US were modeled after the UK system, which these like alms houses, poor farms rose up after the Industrial Revolution and people needing places to go. And so I think that's a really interesting part of the history too.
Right. Yeah.
There's the history that you just gave us around the poor working farms. Can you talk to us a bit about the history of asylums? In Vermont. I mean, I spent, and all of us spent lots of time in Brattleboro, and there's always sort of stories about Brattleboro Retreat, but if you could give us some more concrete history around that, that'd be great.
Definitely. And that history does start with the retreat, which opened in the 1830s with like a very similar sort of philosophy as the Windsor State Prison, where again, previously folks who had been experiencing, you know, different kinds of like mental illness or psychiatric differences or labeling would basically just have been ostracized and lived in pretty inhumane conditions. But the retreat was part of this like more positive movement where people saw, you know, mental illness as something that could be treated and cured, and started with, you know, these really positive intentions in the 1830s. But then over the course of the next few decades, expanded and began to move away from this kind of original vision that it was founded with. So much so that by the 1870s, the legislature actually sent a group of commissioners to investigate what was happening there, because they had gotten so many complaints from people whose family members had been at the retreat, and also were concerned about kind of the continuing investment from the state in an institution that was gaining kind of, you know, a record of abuse and of violence. And Constance McGovern wrote in an article that was published by the Vermont Historical Society that over this period, you know, from the 30s to the 70s or 80s, the retreat moved from curing most folks to merely incarcerating them. Then in the 1880s, the state passed a law that actually moved the financial burden of paying for folks who were staying at the retreat. I shouldn't say staying, but who were, you know, locked in the retreat, from the towns to the state. And what that did was lead to like a huge increase in the amount of folks who were locked up at the retreat, and really spurred the creation of the state hospital in Waterbury, which opened in 1890, I believe. Then both the retreat and the state hospital, their populations continued to grow in the coming decades. And then they both played a really key role in the eugenics movement, because the growing population in these institutions was kind of used as evidence of growing degeneracy, as it was often termed. And they also provided kind of the infrastructure for the movement itself, where, you know, the records that they kept and that poor farms also kept were then used by eugenics researchers to investigate families that were suspected of passing on degeneracy.
One of the things I came across was like sort of who's like the good Vermonter and who do we want in our state? Mm-hmm. And I think this is really important, because when we link like what you're saying to today and who is in prison, who is incarcerated. And for instance, I'll just talk about women because we're talking right now about a woman's prison. Is a lot of Vermonters that are incarcerated are people who are in there because of drug-related charges. Would you say I'm correct on that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. And I know, like with my work around women, so many women who are incarcerated have long histories of abuse and suffering and trauma. And oftentimes drugs and addiction is used as a coping mechanism for all of that, right? So there's like, we forget about the histories of these people. I think that it's important to talk about this because of the conversations that happen right now in Vermont, which is a lot of against people asking for money on the street. We are afraid of these people. We don't want them in our sight. We want them off Main Street. We want them like over there in some sort of like rundown motel, or we definitely don't want them to see them on our main streets. And this is so linked to the history of Vermont because of the long history of Vermont being a tourist state and trying to attract certain people to the state. Yeah. And I think that it's like important to see how these are just new forms of it, but this has been the essence of it for a long, long time, of who is the good Vermonter. And there's actually this like horrid history of eugenics that you just mentioned. So I'm wondering, with all that, could you tell us a bit like who were the targets of eugenics and how you would think about the commonality with it today?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And before we kind of get to that, I want to take one step back to what you're just talking about with tourism.
Yeah.
Because around this period of like the 1880s, 1890s is really the first time that you see an intentional effort to market the state towards tourists. Because eugenics and, you know, tourism in many ways were responses to crises of capitalism, where folks who had been able to make a living in Vermont working in different industrial sectors or in agriculture were no longer able to make a living around that time, because with the railroad moving west and, you know, being easier to grow crops and ship goods like in the Midwest and out west, folks could no longer compete economically in Vermont. And so over the course of the 1880s and 1890s, the population stayed basically exactly stable because so many people were moving out. And then you also have these farms where people could no longer make a living that were now being abandoned. And so that kind of led to this like collective crisis of like, oh my gosh, what is happening, as, you know, as they would have said at the time, to like the old Vermont stock. And that's where white supremacy kind of comes in to like fill the gap, where, again, just like with, you know, the prison boom in California, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore describes, there could have been so many different responses in that moment to make sure that everybody could have made a living, you know, and responded to this sort of like changing geography. But instead, the response was eugenics, which specifically targeted people who were seen as quote, you know, feeble-minded or degenerate, which when you actually look at it, were often people who were kind of like living on the fringes of capitalism. And I think it's actually really telling that then in the 1920s and 30s, when the eugenics movement gets kind of more formalized through the Eugenics Survey of Vermont, the families who they end up targeting, you know, and kind of investigating and publishing about in the most detail were labeled as like the pirate and gypsy families. And you know, who are pirates and gypsies, but people who, you know, are both, you know, often racialized as non-white, but also especially who are kind of on the fringes of capitalism, who are able to survive in ways that are not integrated, you know, into capitalist economies. And so there was this kind of big focus on folks, yeah, who were seen as kind of like unproductive, you know, who then get labeled as feeble-minded or degenerate, and a really intentional effort, like you're talking about with tourism, to bring in folks, you know, like they would do explicit marketing at like universities in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, trying to bring folks, you know, with money to basically invest in these landscapes that were no longer productive for capitalism. So I think that's really important, because when we think about what's going on today, there are so many folks, especially after the pandemic, not after the pandemic, but who are displaced by the pandemic and by the lack of a more like substantive, humane response to the pandemic, who are now left out. That struggle is more visible, and like the dispossession is more visible. And the response in many ways is the same, is about targeting and criminalizing those who, yeah, seen as the problem, when the root of the problem is really a capitalist and imperialist system that is never designed to actually provide, you know, what people need.
That's really interesting. And I think about a couple things. One, the term flatlander that I hear all the time, and I've heard since I came here, and the narrative around our opioid crisis and who's bringing drugs up the highways. And I also think back to who was being targeted by eugenics and native populations, and as a yet another means of dispossessing them of whatever land they may have had left at that point. Seeing that as a big target as well, targeting them in this process. Again, I remember the governor very, I think they called it something like, I forgot the words they used for him, but to come out and say that we have an opioid crisis in the state of Vermont, it was a big deal nationwide for the governor to kind of declare that, connecting that again to the state response to something, to a crisis, to our crisis in capitalism.
Yeah, no, I think that's right on. And I think also, yeah, thinking about the response, I think it's also important to kind of to underline what we see as kind of like the driving purpose of this research, where again, this is, you know, leaning on Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work. You know, she talks about how the only reason that she does any of her kind of research and analysis and writing is to help us understand like where and how to fight. And so I hope that in kind of connecting and illuminating these different systems, it becomes clear, you know, what we're actually fighting. Just want to make one more point to kind of connect eugenics to like the modern day prison system. So in the early 1980s, as the prison system was really expanding both in Vermont and across the country, the Vermont DOC developed what they called an objective classification tool, which in their words, put them at the forefront of objective decision making across the country, according to fair, equitable, and objective criteria. But once you actually look at what those criteria were, it's very clear that this is just an extension of the same kind of violence against the same kind of populations, where it emphasized greater incarceration and surveillance over people who had experienced prior psychiatric hospitalization, outpatient psychotherapy, special education or remedial help, who were not raised by an intact biological family, but a history of being on welfare, or even, you know, as they say, just homosexuality. And so, you know, all of these different things, you know, psychiatric labeling, you know, special education, queerness, not being raised by an intact biological family, all these attributes were either already targeted by eugenics or a result of being targeted and having your family separated, you know, by eugenics. And yeah, I think that's really important to note, because again, this is kind of couched in the language of what's equitable and fair and objective, which is the same kind of language that we hear today. And today, you know, Vermont is only like 1.5 or 2% Black, yet Black folks make up 4.5% of the population that's under like community supervision, so probation, parole, or furlough, and almost 12% of the prison population. So a wildly disproportionate number. And then even within the prison, where, you know, they don't have it separated by different categories as a whole, so it's just lumped in as BIPOC, but BIPOC folks make up 7% of Vermont's population. but 17% of the prison population, but then also over 20% of the solitary confinement population. So again, when we're thinking about who's targeted, who's punished, who's criminalized, the same sorts of folks who are targeted by eugenics are still disproportionately facing state violence today. And the prison is a tool of that, both in general of who's incarcerated, but then also within the prison. The folks who are most likely to face the most targeted violence, even within that environment, you know, again, are people of color. So I think it's important to kind of lay that out, you know, across those different levels.
It makes me think of in our school and the arc of Springfield being a along the river industrial town and booming in the turn of the century and starting its decline in the 30s, 40s, 50s as the factories moved out, loss of jobs and all of those things. And I think about the things that cause my students stress today and really, really intense stress: homelessness, food insecurity, the cost of transportation, finding any kind of jobs that pay, and that kind of stress is tremendous, and it really inhibits kind of their participation in education. And they're also, as we look at our studies in school, they're the ones that are most targeted for discipline and the highest rates of dropout, et cetera. The cycle is just repeating itself, and they're facing that state violence and all of the other things that you're describing yet again, because of poverty, because of the system that's not providing or participating with them.
Yeah, we actually had an event just last night here in Brattleboro talking about some plans that DCF, the Department of Children and Families, has to expand their ability to hold kids in different settings, both at the sheriff's office in Brattleboro and then also at the Brattleboro retreat. And yeah, so just yet again, you know, evolving iterations of these different systems. And there's a study that I think was from 2014 by UVM, which showed that 23% of folks who were incarcerated at that time in Vermont had been in foster care at some point during their youth, which, again, like you're talking about, Anna, in terms of like family policing systems, you know, and social services that really developed in like the early 1900s, around the same period as eugenics, just such clear connections, you know, to who's facing the like disproportionate amount of violence, both, you know, by the state and extra legal violence. And yeah, the just like complete inadequacy of prisons and our current responses to be able to address and repair and break those cycles of violence.
And that reminds me of Victoria Law's book, Prison by Any Other Name, that we actually had her on our show, and Maya Chenoir. And Grace was an advocate at the Crisis Center. We ran a book study on that with social workers. And I think it's such an important book because social services are so often seen as the sort of solution for the suffering that people experience, like whether it's homelessness or addiction or, you know, mental distress. And so there's these different nonprofits that come in and kind of scoop that up or try and help. But I feel like the thing that I've really come to and come to understand when people talk about this term, the nonprofit industrial complex, is that it's very much part and parcel of capitalism, that it is essential also to the system. And I think that can be a confusing point to people, because people who are, say, want to like defund the police or prison abolition often say, well, we need to fund better our social welfare systems and our nonprofits, but we need to like continue to have a critique of the nonprofit and how nonprofits also function to continue to track people, to surveil people, but just in a different way. And I feel like that book, that Prison by Any Name, really speaks to that, I think is helpful.
The exhaust from the prison van's going to heaven, but I'm going to Attica. Gonna put 100 miles between me and my dealing habit. I'm watching Poughkeepsie move by, in the afternoon rain. My hands are turning blue from these cuffs they got me in. I tried to keep my job at the dollar store. Found out my mom was sick, dollar wasn't enough no more. I promise you, mama, I'ma get you them pills. I got me a box of bags and a baker's scale. 15 grams of heroin, an ounce of speed. 15 years to life. Rockefeller, Rockefeller, Rockefeller. That's a long old time.
Well, Jonathan, to continue with this, I was thinking about, again, about our town and the arc of our losing its industrial base and the parallel with that, with the explosion of prison building and incarceration in this country. And if you could talk to that a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, thinking about Vermont, we really see the prison population boom at the same time as, you know, across the country. Like in the mid 70s, the population really starts to rise and then doesn't stop rising, you know, until the 90s or early 2000s. And again, like we mentioned earlier, this was the moment when CRCF was built. The prison that everyone now agrees should close was built at this time, actually kind of as part of a wave of reforms, you know, sort of similar to what you were talking about, Anna, thinking about a place that wouldn't be like a prison. You know, again, remembering that quote from the DOC commissioner at the time, talking about how the traditional closed institution has a consistent record of failure. They were operating on what was called the community corrections model, which was really envisioned as something very different that would keep people closer to home, that would have, you know, more kind of integration with like job programs and community programs and more community resources. And the explanation for this new prison was that, yeah, in these outdated facilities, they just, you know, couldn't maintain the same kinds of programs that would be so beneficial towards rehabilitation. But then within a couple of years, you know, as you see kind of the rising, you know, law and order, which was part of the pushback to, you know, the long civil rights movement and Black Power movements, and also, you know, not just politically a response to those movements, but also materially a response to, you know, all these people becoming surplus. Like we talked about, you know, the economic crises of the times and jobs, like you're talking about in Springfield, Chris, moving elsewhere, you know, more and more people are getting criminalized. And so the prison population booms, you know, then the DOC complains that, ah, we just can't complete these programs, you know, in the same way that we wanted to, because we have too many people. And then by 1983, so this is just 8 years after CRCF opens, as the pilot for community corrections in 1975. And in 1983, the DOC is talking about what they called jails without walls, which completely flipped the logic, where instead of bringing sort of like the values and resources of the community into the prison, they were then trying to extend the surveillance and the coercion of the prison out into the community, because they had too many people to incarcerate. So they were trying to make community supervision more and more kind of coercive, surveilled, and punitive, which led really directly to kind of what you're talking about, Anna, with like prison by any other name, you know, of like house arrest, you know, develops around that time, and like different like daily drug treatment programs that are used to kind of surveil people when you could, you know, offer that same sort of treatment in like a once a month dose. And so I think that's really crucial, you know, that moment of the early 70s, because one, you know, again, CRCF, which everyone, even the most staunch prison advocates, agree should close, was at the time seen as this new rehabilitative place in many of the ways that this new prison is promised to be. And thinking about what we were talking about earlier with Ruth Wilson Gilmore and kind of the understanding of like, what does the prison actually do? You know, what purpose does it serve beyond the walls? You can see how all these different surpluses were kind of combined in that moment of crisis where the system could no longer reproduce itself. There were many folks who had been supported by like record social spending in the 50s and 60s that was being rolled back, increasingly punitive laws and longer sentences and more investment in policing and prisons as part of this wave of law and order. And yeah, more and more folks who were surplus, and the state response was to criminalize them. And I think that is so crucial, because that's really what we're seeing today, is more and more people being surplus as we see the rollback, you know, of pandemic era investments, which showed that we can support people in more humane ways. It wasn't perfect, but it was definitely better. It was more comprehensive and more accessible. And now we're rolling those things back, leaving people out, you know, without the sorts of like social supports, mental health supports, you know, housing, food access, all these different things that we need, while, you know, the governor is talking about how the system is all carrots and no sticks, and how, you know, we need to be harsher. And at this point, we're kind of midway through the legislative session, so we'll see what ends up passing. But the bills that have moved between the two houses in the legislature pertaining to criminal justice are essentially all about harshening criminal penalties. And so, again, we can have all of the beautiful promises that we want about what this new place might be and how it'll be so different from those prisons of the past. But when we look at the broader context, it becomes clearer and clearer that if it is built, it will end up just serving the same purpose.
You, at the very beginning, when you introduced yourself, you talked about different things that you do, and you mentioned the word community safety. So I'm wondering, what does that mean to you? What's your vision for safe communities? What do you think needs to be happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and I think ultimately it's about meeting all of the needs that we're talking about, right? Around housing, around food, around, you know, mental health support, around education, you know, people being able to access the things that we all need to live. And right now, those things are increasingly inaccessible, increasingly commodified, and the folks who can't access them are increasingly criminalized. In terms of, you know, what that actually looks like, there are a million things that can look like, right? And that's something that I think we're all figuring out in our different communities together. But a key part of it is ensuring that we don't invest, you know, in these systems that we know don't keep us safe, that we know don't provide for people's well-being. And that, yeah, like we talked about of, you know, the good Vermonter and the bad Vermonter, you know, are kind of red herrings. But yeah, again, thinking about this kind of picture of the history of Vermont, you know, all these different systems being tied together, you know, the common thread is capitalism and is white supremacy and is imperialism. And so, you know, I think community safety ultimately looks like struggles against those systems, and then necessarily struggles for, you know, recommoning and making available to everyone all of the different things that we need to live.
Yeah, thanks for that. Let me ask you, is there anything else you'd like to add? I know we have so much more we could talk about, and we can do a part two.
Yeah, I mean, there are 1,000 different threads to pull on, you know, in this conversation. It's so interconnected. But yeah, I guess I would maybe end by just, you know, sharing, if folks take away one thing from this conversation, it's that we've been here before, right? And we've had the same kind of rhetoric time and again at different moments of crisis in Vermont history, and we've reproduced the same kinds of violent systems. And so again, thinking about that line from Ruth Wilson Gilmore about using this sort of understanding and framework to help us identify where and how to fight, I hope that as it becomes clearer and clearer how these reforms have gotten us here, that we need different solutions. And I think that's what we're going to talk about more next time. And yeah, really, really looking forward to that conversation. And thank you so much for having me on to talk tonight.
Yeah, Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Jonathan Elwell in Brattleboro talking with Chris and I about the history of Vermont prisons. We want to thank Jonathan. And this is part one of a two-part show looking at Vermont prisons and looking at the proposal for a new women's prison, in which there is a lot of debate around. And our part two is going to focus more on that situation with the new women's prison and the organizing that is happening around that. So thank you for tuning in today.
Remember to subscribe on whatever podcast app you use. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Indigo Radio. We're going to go out with Public Enemy and Black Steel. Thanks, everyone.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn, I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive or on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the sprint of situations unreal, I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steel.
Yo, Chuck, we gon' break you out of here, man. Words of strength, G.
I'm going for that steel.
Word up, G. They're trying to put black out of the game by keeping you in there, you know what I'm saying? But they can't keep a good man down.
On death row, I grabbed his gun and he did what I said so. And every man's the man got served, along with the time they served. Decency was deserved. To understand my demands, I gave a warning. I wanted the governor, y'all, and plus the warden to know that I was innocent. Because I'm militant, posing a threat, you better s*** government.
Yeah.
My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. My boys had the feds in check, they couldn't try nothing. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This is what it takes for peace, so I just took the peace. Black for black, it's high time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto, no sellout. Six COs we got, we ought to put their head out. But I'll give them a chance, cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman CO to call me a copter. She tried to get away, and I popped her twice, right? No one to get nice. I had six COs, and now it's five to go, and I'm serious. Call me delirious, but I'm still a captive. I gotta rap this time to break as time grows a tent. I got my steel in my right hand, now I'm looking for the fence.
Hey yo, Chuck, we got the dope plan in effect. G, word to the strength, man.
I'm looking for that fence.
Word, I got the 98 posse, Professor Griffin, the S1s. Yo, Chuck, we coming, man.
As I ventured into the courtyard, followed by 52 brothers, bruised, battered, and scarred, but hard. Going out with a bang, ready to bang out. The power from the sky, from the tower, shots rang out. A high number in dose, yes, and something close. I figure I trigger my steel stand and hold my post. This is what I mean, an anti-nigga machine. If I come out alive, then they won't come clean. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up. And to my surprise, the wall and tower blew up. Who shot what, who, what, the bazooka was who? And to my rescue, it was the S1W. Secure my getaway, so I just got away. The joint broke from the black smoke. Then they saw it was rougher than the average bluffer, cause the steel was black, the attitude exact. Now the chase is on, telling you to come on. 53 brothers on the run, and we are gone.